We're heading to our second speaker, Bruce Tuckman. Bruce, as I mentioned, is the former chief economist at the CFTC, the Commodities Futures Trading Company Commission, which is an independent government agency. Bruce was a previous rapporteur jour and professor at NYU, and I'm very interested in learning from Bruce what it was like to move from the private sector to an independent government agency. Bruce, go ahead.
Thanks, Larry. So having spent all of my life really in the private sector, the thing that struck me the most about my time at the CFTC is how much power and discretion an independent agency has in its work, and even more so how our system of government is designed to try to check that power and discretion. So first of all, what makes an agency independent? The answer is actually different for different agencies. But for the CFTC, it's the fact that the commissioners are, of course, appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, but then they cannot be removed except for cause, unlike the Secretary of the Treasury that the president can fire at any time. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the CFTC rules have the force of law, but they're not reviewed by the White House. They don't go through the White House the way the Department of Labor regulations would do so. So as a result, the agency, in particular the chair who manages the staff, has an enormous amount of discretion. What do I mean by discretion? Well, what rulemakings you're going to take up. The Dodd-Frank rulemaking, for example, took 10 years at the CFTC, and the SEC, another independent agency, is actually still going on Dodd-Frank. So there are actually a lot of choices you can make along the way. Another part of the discretion is how to interpret congressional statutes. There's a lot of discussion in the courts about that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But how do you interpret what Congress told you to do? There's also no action letters, which is a lot of what an agency does, which is say, hey, in a particular situation, a particular actor doesn't have to follow this rule on a temporary basis, on a permanent basis, because their situation is slightly different. And then finally, where to focus enforcement. So in a world of limited resources, choices have to be made about which cases are going to be brought against people who are violating the rules of the agency. So now, what are the checks on this very broad power and discretion? So I'm going to list five checks. The first one is Congress. So Congress can drag the chair in and ask questions and hold hearings, which of course, depending on what their views are, can be pleasant or unpleasant. Congress also sets the budget each year for the CFTC. Now, this is actually less of a check for other agencies. So the SEC, for example, has its own sources of money from fees from the industry. And the Fed, of course, has its own revenue-making machine there. But for the CFTC, that was a check because they had to ask Congress for money every year. The only thing I would say about that check is not all issues rise to Congress' attention. It has to be certain kinds of issues that it's going to get Congress to think about things like that. The second check is the fact that there are minority commissioners. So there are three commissioners from the party of the president, and two from the other party. So non-controversial rules are just going to pass through an internal process. Every commissioner is just going to sign off, and it's done. It has the force of law. But any commissioner can refuse to go through that process and force a public meeting and a vote on the rule. And the minority commissioner can dissent publicly. And that is a great, I think, incentive to negotiate and to compromise and come to the right place. I really was impressed that this is an extremely big deal. And this is a very personal opinion why I don't like the single commissioner structure at the CFPB, because you don't have these other commissioners who are very involved in the issues who can get up and dissent publicly. The third of the five checks I want to talk about, and this is something I knew nothing about before I entered government, is the APA, or the Administrative Procedures Act. So there are a whole set of rules about making rules. There are two types of lawyers at the CFTC. There are the securities law lawyers who worry about securities law, and then there are the APA lawyers who are all about how you go about making rules. I think I'm not a lawyer, so I'm sure I'm not going to get this 100% right. But the basic idea is rules have to come from reasoned decision making. They can't be arbitrary and capricious, which is one of the legal phrases. And this is reviewable by courts. So the courts can decide if a particular rule follows these criteria. And there's a big debate in the legal profession, which I'm not super qualified to talk about how much courts should defer to agencies when they make the rules. And another part of the APA, which is very important, is that when an agency is going to make a rule, it has to make a proposal, give notice that it's thinking about making a rule, open up the proposal for public comment. And all serious comments will be read and will be addressed in the rulemaking. So if anyone on this call has a view about something an agency is doing and they write it, it's almost 100% sure it's going to be read and extremely likely it's going to be addressed in the final rulemaking. So the result of that, rulemaking takes a lot of time. It's particularly difficult for a new administration to come in and reverse course from a proposal that's already existing. How do you make the argument that, hey, this agency stood before the public and said, this is the most sensible thing to do, and now you're doing something completely different? And of course, every administration has a limited amount of time in which to do things. The fourth of the list of checks that I want to talk about are cost-benefit considerations. So rules under certain statutes, like the Commodity Exchange Act, which is what the CFTC works with, require cost-benefit considerations. So when a proposal is made, you have to list out all of the costs and benefits of what's going to be the effect, the impact in this rule. You don't have to weigh them one against another, but you have to list them. And a rule can be challenged in court if important costs and benefits are omitted. Now, interestingly, cost-benefit considerations are not required of all statutes. For example, the Bank Holding Company Act does not require a cost-benefit considerations in rulemaking under that act, and that's where the Volcker Rule lives. So the Volcker Rule didn't have to do that, as a lot of other Dodd-Frank rules had to do. And then the final check, the fifth and final check I want to talk about, is civil servants. So civil servants have lots of protections. A new administration, as existed in the founding of our country, the new administration can no longer come in and just fire everyone and start from scratch. There are also detailed procedures for hiring senior civil servants to prevent what's called burrowing. And that's a word I did not know, again, before joining the government. And that's when political appointees try to hire senior civil servants, try to hire other political appointees as senior civil servants. And there are a lot of procedures to prevent that from happening. I, for example, was not allowed on a particular hiring committee because I was a political appointee. So on the whole, I would say I think that civil servants that I bumped into and worked with responded very well to direction from the chair, recognizing the new administration. Here's what the chair wants to do, and that chair is confirmed by the Senate. We should do that. But of course, in theory, it's possible for senior servants to have their own agenda or to slow walk any particular administration. So, Larry, those were most of my prepared remarks. Should we stop there?
Sure.